ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to A Big Country. I'm Clint Jasper, and it's great to have your company as we head out with our reporters around the country. This week, we're meeting researchers who've travelled from Germany to study a little-known shrimp found in the lakes of Tasmania's alpine regions. It's known as a living fossil, having barely changed since the Triassic period. We're visiting a vineyard where the owners are investing in the future and operating completely off-grid through a solar and battery farm. And it's the end of an era for a beloved berry farm. After three decades, a Queensland couple are stepping away from growing and selling strawberries. It's been hard work, but also rewarding seeing familiar faces return to the farm each year to pick their own fruit.
Watching all the people that come out here, they're pregnant when they come here, and they're still coming now and their kids are 13 years old. You know, we've grown up, we're like your grandparents to those kids.
We'll visit that berry farm that's been a favourite for generations of families as the owners prepare to pass it on to a new generation of growers. That is coming up. First today, the wool was flying off the board at a shearing competition in southern New South Wales recently. More than 100 shearers from across Australia were taking part in a speed shearing event, vying for a place on a team to compete in Wales later this year. For the first time, the event included a section for female shearers, and reporter Emily Doak went along to find out more.
Shearers, nod your heads. 3, 2, 1, go.
Loud music, live commentary, and furious action.
And he's hit the long blow there and absolutely flying.
The speed shear all comes down to shearing just one sheep as quickly and cleanly as possible. Too many nicks or wool left on will see you disqualified. And most can do it in under 30 seconds.
26, 27, looking for the cord.
Organiser Atta Takanawa Siminoff says the sport is gaining in popularity.
Oh, we're lucky enough to host the Wales team this year. The Royal Welsh Committee have sent over a first ever speed share team. New Zealand, Falkland Islands, Scotland. Yeah, so we've got a few internationals.
And a few locals as well have taken part?
Definitely a few locals, but we also have an event called State of the States. So we have the best of those states here as well. They're the top two that have made those classes. And they'll challenge to go to Wales as well. To be recognised internationally, that's how we want to sort of promote our industry. A lot of people aren't aware of the agriculture industry within shearing, but also that our industry has had a hit and we just want to encourage people to come along into that industry. Yeah.
And something unique's happening here in terms of you've got a special section for women. Why has that been incorporated?
I myself enjoy shearing, not the best, but I wanted to promote that as well. And as we would see and know within the industry, a lot of women are coming up to your records. We have one that's got two world records on. She's the first ever woman to have ewe and lamb record at the same time. So it's history, really, history making.
And I love the title, you've called it I Am Woman. Mm-hmm. So this is showing that women are here in this industry making a difference.
I'm empowered by them myself too, so I enjoy it.
How do you think that the women compete with the men in something like speed shearing?
I think the way that they have picked up and taken it to a professional level, I think they give them the shakes now. Yeah, it's just anyone's game, they're that good.
Sasha Bond broke three world records last year, including shearing 720 lambs over 9 hours. But she says, unlike the endurance record, speed shearing means you've just got one chance to get it right.
With a speed shear, you only have one sheep. So, you know, your comb selection, your footwork, and calming your nerves have to be quite quick. Whereas with a record, you have all day to do it, so
time to get into the rhythm.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
What about the actual physicality of it? Do you put in much training?
For the records or the speed shears?
For both, and for work.
I train a lot. For the world records, I train 7 days a week in the gym, an hour a day, and shore 7 days if I could, weather permitting. And it helps out heaps with my shearing day to day. And it was essential for the days of the records. fitness levels have to be right on if you want to push your body to those kind of limits.
And I suppose looking at the role of women in the industry more generally, we're seeing that here there is a special division, I Am Woman division. As someone who's been at the top levels of performance in the industry, how do you see the move to sort of have a separate section for women?
I think it's great. It would be good if the prize money was a bit closer to the males division, but in saying that too, because I'm a woman, I can compete in both divisions, where a male can't compete in the women's division and the open or any other grade. So in a way, I'm sort of lucky because I get a test, a trial run before. It's cool to see so many women getting up and having a go.
Okay, so my name's Tania Tufangai. I've been a wool classer for 25 years and we've got a shearing run in Western Australia. So my great-grandmother, she was one of the first female shearers in New Zealand, so it's just been something we're born with.
Do you reckon it's a good career for a woman?
I think so. With the price of shearing now, you can make a good quid and yes, definitely a good lifestyle as well.
So you're all the way in Wagga Wagga, New South Wales, and you're competing today in the speed sheet?
Yep. I entered in the novice, but I didn't do very good. I got red-lighted, so that means you're DQ'd, so the quality wasn't quite there.
26, 27 seconds have been our fastest two so far this morning.
So this is all of our barrels from 2023. So we've got all the Pinot Noir's been barreled down now, and the Chardonnay. We've got a couple of Pinot Gris barrels too, which is exciting. We didn't do any Pinot Gris in barrel last year, so we thought we'd give it a bit of a trial, and we're really happy with the results. So.
At this off-grid winery at Sidmouth in Tasmania's Tamar Valley, James Oliver and his partner Constance have just wrapped up a very pleasing vintage.
Oh, it was a fantastic vintage. Yeah, the fruit was in pristine condition, beautiful, beautiful quality. You know, we just had such a perfect growing season. Not much rain, but that helped in reducing the disease pressure. We gave the vines a little bit of water here and there just to keep, you know, a nice healthy canopy. And we started picking, I think it was the first week of March with the Chardonnay for sparkling, and then followed by Pinot Noir. So still picking in mid-March. So even though it was a hot, dry year, and according to a lot of people, I think it's one of the earliest on records, still picking in mid-March. So I think there's still plenty of ripening, all the long, drawn-out ripening for the grapes. So beautiful flavours, you know, slightly riper this year than last year, but good natural acidity, so we're really excited. Generally in warmer years, flavour tends to occur at slightly higher sugar, so we were just kind of waiting for the flavour to arrive. You know, so we're picking things, you know, just a little bit riper this year, but the cool nights did kick in. When did they kick in? Kind of mid-Feb, and so that tends to help the grapes retain their natural acidity. So even though they're a little bit riper and the Pinots are a bit darker, they've still got great freshness.
Hello, I'm Larissa Smith. And I've caught up with James at Moores Hill Estate, which he and Constance purchased in 2022. While this year's growing season has been on the warmer side, it's the cooler climate here in northern Tasmania that lured the couple to move from the mainland down south.
I remember back to 18 and 19. So I started working in the Yarra in 2017 at Yarring Station, which is a fantastic place. Learned a lot. Yeah, there were a couple of really hot vintages. I remember 18 and 19 particularly being very hot. We were picking Pinot mid-Feb, and I just thought, you know, long-term, where do I want to be? Where does Constance and I want to be? We want to grow high-quality Pinot long into the future. I think with a changing climate, we thought Tassie was probably the place to be. When you look at this year, it was a warm year, but we didn't really have any temperature over kind of early 30s. So I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful place to grow fruit.
Did it take you long to find somewhere suitable that you want, where you wanted to live as well?
We were originally looking around Macedon Ranges because that's quite a cool area in Victoria, but prices did shoot up during COVID. People wanted to move out of Melbourne. We came down to Tassie in 2021, just not with the intention to find a place to move to, but just to explore. So eating and drinking and hiking and kind of fell in love with it. So we kept an eye on it, and when Moores Hill popped up for sale, we just thought it was too good to be true because it's such an amazing property. You know, Rod and Karen were the first owners. They did a fantastic job to plant the vineyard and set the cellar door up, and then Fee and Jules took it to the next level with the winery and the expansion of the vineyard in 15. So we're really, really lucky. It's up to us to kind of take it to the next level, hopefully.
Has it been a bit of a daunting process taking on a vineyard and a business together?
The business side of things, absolutely. The vineyard and the winemaking, I don't think was ever going to be, I shouldn't say, it's still challenging, but it was something we had experience in. Running a business was definitely something we didn't have experience in, so that's been the most challenging aspect. And probably not having much of a life outside of work, to be honest. We don't have too many days off, but hopefully that will change soon.
What's particularly unique about Moss Hill is that you're off-grid. How does that work?
Yeah, that was one of the things that attracted us. So that the winery is completely off-grid. It's powered by 108 solar panels. And last year we replaced the batteries from lead acid to lithium ion. So we now have greater capacity, and we can run the cellar door off solar too. So, for a couple of months of the year, there's more of a demand on the system.
How much do they cost?
It's about $1,000 a kilowatt. That's the rule of thumb. So depending on how many kilowatt hours you put in, we put in 45. So you can do the numbers. It's not cheap, but it's important to us. I think it's part of our philosophy. It's part of the brand identity, and we love that. We're investigating connecting the winery off-grid system to the dam, so we can pump water via solar. At the moment, we're using a petrol pump. We want to plant a few more vines. We've pulled out some Cabernet Merlot. We want to plant there. We've got some more land now, so we want to plant another 3 hectares in the future. And the current irrigation system is not adequate. So, yeah, we're talking to Marty from Mode to run a cable from the winery to the dam and use all this solar energy during the summer to irrigate. So it's exciting.
What excites you the most about the future of the Tasmanian wine industry?
I think the wines are just so beautiful, so balanced. I come back to that long, drawn-out ripening. They just have an extra level of flavour that other regions maybe don't tend to achieve, especially for those cool climate wines like Pinot and Chardonnay. No major heat spikes. I don't think the vines like, 40-plus degree days. I think the climate is just perfect. Even with a changing climate, I still think there's just amazing future to grow, high quality fruit. It's just such good community. We felt welcome straight off the bat. So we're really, really happy to be here. It's a great spot.
James Oliver from Moore Hills Estate in the Tamar Valley of Northern Tassie. He was speaking to Larissa Smith. Before that, Emily Doak took us to the speed shearing competition in southern New South Wales. You can read more on those stories on the ABC homepage, abc.net.au. Just look for A Big Country. I'm Clint Jasper with you for A Big Country. Still to come, we're meeting the Queensland couple whose escape to the country in the 1980s led them to a passion for growing strawberries. And we're learning about the Tasmanian mountain shrimp, a special crustacean only found in the state's alpine area and known as a living fossil. It's so special that two German researchers keep returning to Tasmania to study it. Reporter Georgie Burgess went up Kainanyi, Mount Wellington, to meet the researchers and learn more about the shrimp.
There's one.
And a little one. That's a little one.
Where? Right here, right under my finger.
Oh, yes, there. I can see it.
Yeah. Then there's one on the stone right there.
We are actually at Mount Wellington at the Shelley, and that's a very special place for us because here lives the Tasmanian mountain shrimp, Anaspidus, and this is actually the reason why we came all the way from Germany here to Tasmania to study these very remarkable and iconic Tasmanian mountain shrimps.
Yep,
got one.
I'm Stefan Richter. I'm a professor for zoology at Rostock University in Germany.
So this shrimp must be pretty special to get you all that way here. Why is it so important to research this shrimp?
It is very special indeed. So I came across with this species already when I did my PhD in the beginning of the 1990s, because the entire group, not only this little group of shrimps here in Tasmania, but there's a broader group, Anaspidacea. they are very enigmatic. Nobody really knows where to place them in the tree of life of all crustaceans. So that is why I first started to become interested in this group. And then I noticed a few years later that actually also the distribution of the species, actually now we know these are at least 8 different species, that the distribution in Tasmania is very interesting because it can be related actually to geology, geomorphology, to hydrology, to caves. So it has an entire story just with the shrimp in its focus.
So is the shrimp a living fossil?
You could say that. Because living fossil actually just means that the morphology, so how they look like, didn't change in millions of years. And we have fossils which look very, very similar, almost exactly like the Anaspides here, which are from the Triassic. This is more than 200 million years ago.
So does studying this shrimp help you study the past?
Definitely. So we are mostly interested in evolutionary biology. So we are evolutionary biologists. And that is, of course, very interesting. But it's not only the very far past, so the Mesozoic, the Triassic. It is also the more recent past, actually, the glaciation in Tasmania. The distribution of Anaspides was strongly depends on the glaciation which happened here the last 10,000, 100,000 and up to 2 million years in Tasmania. So I think our research is also of interest for people who are interested in the geology and in the evolution of the Tasmania, so not only in the evolution of this shrimp.
Are there many creatures around that can give us that much history?
Oh, definitely, there are many in Tasmania, and everyone knows them, platypus and echidna and the others. But this one is also very special because it's freshwater. And the other very special thing is actually that they appear very often in caves. This was not known until 50, 60 years ago. That was not known, but now actually the Tasmanian cavers did a lot of studies and recorded and noticed them in the cave. And this is actually we are now interested in the immigration into the caves, from the surface into the caves. And this is actually the project of my student Christoph.
Did you see it?
Hi, my name is Christoph Hoepel. I'm a PhD student from the University of Rostock.
And how did you get involved in the mountain shrimp?
It all started back in 2017 when I was approached by my professor Stefan Richter coming to Tasmania to dive in the lakes because I'm a trained scientific diver.
So you dive down in some of Tasmania's iconic lakes to find this creature?
We dived in Great Lake, in Arthur's Lake, Woods Lake, Lake St. Clair.
And what did you find?
We actually found the specimens. In Lake St. Clair, there's a special species only occurring in Lake St. Clair. And in Great Lake and Arthur Lake, there's a different genus of anaspidations called Paranaspides.
Right now, we're here on Mount Wellington Kunanyi in a sort of a small mountain pond. Is this a bit of a hotspot where you know you can find the shrimp?
Yeah, you can call it a little bit of a hotspot. Yeah, it's a very easy one to get and they are in good numbers here and it's always really nice and easy to get here and sometimes even just sit here and observe.
And so I can see a couple of small fishing nets that you might use to put a goldfish in a tank type thing. Talk me through what you do when you are going about your research.
Normally already the preparation for each trip takes probably an hour or two in the morning, depending if we go to a cave or a mountain tarn. And we always have this little fishing nets with us. We always have bright torches because in the shaded pools, it's sometimes really hard to see them. And then you basically walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours until you get to the place where you want to get. And then you sit on the edge of the pond for 2 hours sometimes and collecting 5 specimens.
I can guarantee that most Tasmanians have probably never even heard of the mountain shrimp. Why do you think it's important people know about it and understand it?
It's a very unique animal. This Anaspides is endemic to Tasmania. It occurs only in mountain tarns and caves and is very vulnerable to climate change and pollution. And you should also just know the animals around you and the iconic ones you have here.
Every winter morning for the past 30 years, Marg and Alan Ballantyne have risen in the early hours pulled on their boots and ventured into their strawberry fields. The couple didn't discover their love of farming until a fateful trip to Cameron's Pocket, about an hour north of Mackay, in tropical North Queensland.
Back in the 80s, we're both working out at German Creek, and we met some friends out there that owned a property across the other side of here. They said, come on down for the weekend to Cameron's Pocket. I said, oh, rightio. And we come down here, and they said, I'll take you up to this waterhole, it's pretty famous. Oh, rightio. And there was a for sale sign going up to the waterhole. So, oh, look at this here, we could buy this little block. It was 60 acres at the time. So it started from there, we bought that block. And then this other block came up for sale, 130 acres on it. So we started playing around with that. Not with strawberries, we tried a lot of crops. We had citrus.
And
pawpaws. Then pawpaws. And then we thought, oh, we'll sell this product up at Ely Beach. So we go there trying to sell oranges and mandarins and a bit of juice. And I thought, God, that guy's got a lot of people in his store. What's he selling? And it was strawberries. I thought, wow, now there's an opportunity. We should start growing a few strawberries.
Hello, I'm Ashley Bagshaw, and I'm chatting with Alan and Marg Ballantyne. In 1995, the couple officially switched to strawberries, and the rest, as they say, is history. But it hasn't always been smooth sailing. Marg and Alan started out supplying to supermarkets and local businesses, but quickly found themselves frustrated by the lack of returns. That's when they made the life-changing choice to completely pivot their business model.
We're not getting the money that we deserve for the effort we're putting in. So, oh, let's try the highway. It really took off. Oh, this will work. We'll keep doing this. And then the highway got busy and busy. We dropped the Ely Beach markets out of it and all the retailers and just selling direct on the highway.
Their little roadside stall sat on the side of the Bruce Highway at the tiny town of Kalin. It encouraged travellers to make a stop at the town, which most had never even heard of. The little stall has even garnered an international reputation, according to their son, who had a chance encounter with a fan of the farm in the United States.
Young Jack, he was over in Las Vegas, and they were in a queue lining up for something, I think it was some sort of food. This American lady picked up their accent, said, oh, are you kids Australian? Yeah, yeah. So we just came back from a trip over there, and they got talking. She said, you know, the best job I've ever eaten was on this little highway road stall, and they were unbelievable. And our son Jack pricked his ears up. Oh, that'd be my mum and dad and Kaylin. So they were all excited talking to these people about the strawberries.
The couple's Pick Your Own Attraction, which opened 15 years ago, also draws visitors from across the country.
Margaret came up with the idea, oh, why don't we try Pick Your Own? Oh, yeah, that's probably an idea. So off we go down to Victoria to the Mornington Peninsula. They had a big setup with, oh, this is us. So come back from Victoria, found an old coffee machine and started doing coffee and scones. From there, we just built up. And like today, it's, you know, it's a big affair with Pick Your Own, and we still try to keep the highway going.
But despite the widespread acclaim, Mark Ballantyne says the most rewarding part was seeing the return of familiar faces.
Watching all the people that come out here, they're pregnant when they come here, and they're still coming now and their kids are 13 years old. You know, we've grown up, we're like your grandparents to those kids.
After growing the business from a tiny stall to an agritourism destination, Marg and Alan have decided that it's time for the next chapter. But the new owners of the farm, Tim Malloy and Rose Brady, hope to follow in their footsteps.
Yeah, we plan to continue running as Ella Marg did.
The couple, who traded their mining business in Mackay for a life on the land, says they have memories of visiting the farm with their five children. Marg and Alan will be on hand for one more season to make sure that legacy continues.
We're very appreciative of them hanging around to teach us and mentor us through this.
But the Ballantynes themselves are trading the farm for a seaside view. However, they have promised to always be around to offer advice or a helping hand.
We just want to see them go ahead leaps and bounds, and they have the potential to do that. You know, everything's in place now, the name's there, the branding, and if they just follow what we tell these guys, they can't go wrong with growing the strawberries. They'll be able to grow them and just got to entice the people that come out here to keep coming, you know.
That story from Ashley Bagshaw in North Queensland. And you can read more about the Ballantines stepping back from their strawberry venture. You'll find that and all of the stories on today's program on the ABC homepage. Head to abc.net.au and look for A Big Country. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.